Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Millennial Series of the Walt Weekly Podcast, Friday Night Live. My name is Walter Latham, your host, along with your co-host, Michelle Sweeney McCombs. And finally, the panel. We may only get half the panel tonight, or two-thirds, or one-third of the panel tonight. And Michelle will introduce the panel to you shortly. Let me just take a quick second to explain our millennial series. These are guests that were born into this generation and against the many odds that they were faced with, worked hard to achieve success. And we want to shine a light on that. This is not to say that they have reached the pinnacle of their careers, but are battling it out, with some successes behind them and maybe a great deal more in front of them. This struggle is positioning their children, our future of our community, for the challenges ahead. As I've said, I have confidence that our future is in good hands. So we're going to highlight the millennials when we can. That's why we call it a series. In today's show, we have a millennial, all right, which Michelle will introduce him to you. But the title of today's show is Interview with West Point Grad and Financial Services Executive, Captain Javon Willis, retired. And Michelle?
Hey, thank you, Walter. And welcome, everyone. Welcome. Welcome. Thank you so much. Today's show is sponsored by Michelle Sweeney Hair and Skincare. Our intro and outro music is provided by Uncle Nephew. Today's panel member joining us is Christopher Sweeney out of New Jersey, owner and CEO of Johnny Roo Steakhouse, and also a retired sanitation worker. We appreciate you taking the time out. Thank you to our live audience for joining us. Today's guest, Javon Willis, right? Retired U.S. Army captain and West Point graduate, Javon is a finance executive and U.S. Army officer veteran. He is the global treasury transformation lead at Micro Focus International as a principal consultant. He was a senior director and global operations support leader for treasury operations at GE Capital and operations manager for Enterprise Initiatives, PMO. He was also a vice president at RBS Citizens Bank as strategic program manager and the head of business management, directly supporting the vice chairman and prior VP foreign exchange operations manager. While in the U.S. Army, he was a captain and headquarters company commander for the garrison at West Point, USMA, diversity admissions officer at West Point, Signal Corps Node Center deputy commander and platoon leader, Fort Bliss, Texas, and air missile defense launcher platoon leader in South Korea. Later, he served in the New York National Guards, supporting the domestic all-hazard response team East. I won't give everything away, but you definitely wear a lot of hats, Javon. Thank you for joining us. We appreciate you giving us your time on Friday evening and giving our live audience a listen to who you are and joining us on our millennial segment. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for that wonderful intro.
Yes.
Yeah, before I start out, Javon, a couple of years, folks, Javon and I did an episode on emergency preparedness. Mm-hmm. And that's where we heard the term the go bag. So if there's a hazardous condition, hurricane, right, anything. Mm-hmm. You remember that, Michelle?
Yeah, I actually got a
gold
bag. I got one too.
This was prior to the pandemic.
Yeah, definitely.
Where we were discussing what you needed and can't. Yes.
Yeah, you had to be ready.
Yeah. We were talking, and the the coincidence, and I wouldn't say irony, but then you had COVID, where there's really nowhere to run. You got a mask on. You know what I'm saying? I don't know how that go bag would come into play here.
Yeah, you never know. You never know. Just best to have it at the door.
Yeah, I think that was more on the hunker down and shelter in place mode. So,
yeah, which we did do that, you know. So, but folks, I'm gonna re-broadcast that episode because it's still relevant, and it plays into a lot of what we're seeing. But we're in the twilight zone here.
Yeah.
So anyway, let's get on with Captain Javon Willis retired.
Yes.
And first off, I want to welcome you. Thank you for your service.
Thank you. And first and foremost, I want to say thank you, Mr. Latham, for the invitation to participate in this forum at the All Walt Weekly Show. And also to Michelle and the panel. You all do a great job providing different perspectives and providing a really good conversation. So I appreciate the opportunity to share my story and experience. And hopefully, maybe have a positive impact or maybe inspire something in the next generation. So thanks again for this invitation.
Well, thank you.
Yes, thank you, Javon. Thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule. I know you have small kids, so I know that takes up a lot of time, plus you're working. Yeah. And but we really appreciate you coming on tonight. So let's I want to start with this. You know, let's talk a little bit about where you came from and how it was growing up in the Detroit area.
Yeah. So first and foremost, let me just say my story, like many, is an example of it takes a village to raise a child perspective. I know some other folks have used that as a reference, but I think I've been impacted by so many great people who believed in me, invested time in me, gave me a chance, for my family, teachers, coaches, commanders, supervisors, and a multitude of friends and mentors who even continue to support me today. So I'm grateful and thankful to be here today for that. And so just to give you a little bit, I mean, I know not a lot of people from my area kind of made it to this point. So I feel blessed in that aspect. But to your reference to Detroit, Michigan. I lived there. I was born there and only really lived there for a couple years. I grew up in a town called Lorain, Ohio, probably the 16 years there. My mom was a single mother working as an EKG tech in Detroit. And my father wasn't really in the picture at the time. So, living a single mother, trying to raise three kids in Detroit just wasn't working. And then so my aunts and uncles, came down and helped her move. And then we moved to my grandmother's house where I grew up there. And I felt like Lorain, Ohio was a relatively a good place to live, a good childhood. We technically were considered low income, but it didn't really seem like it initially because we lived in the biggest house on the street. And that was primarily due to my grandfather who had built our family house on the west side in the 1950s or so. This is a predominantly Caucasian neighborhood, and that it gradually transitioned into more of an African American neighborhood. So it was a moment of reflection of my getting to the roots, and my grandfather he was my reference to some African American history. As he was basically one of the first black general contractors in Lorain and built over about 70 houses within that city. And so still have signature chimneys there today. So, he's one of those people that I look back on. He helped build some of the Tuskegee airfields in Alabama where he got his certifications. And that's kind of like where I grew up. The core people who have had that big impact on me was really my grandmother. While I was she's originally from Nashville, Tennessee, believed in corporal punishment, made sure we all had go to church and in Sunday school, sang in the choir, participate in community activities and volunteering. So initially moving to Ohio was difficult for my mom. She had trouble finding a job, had to switch careers in the height of the deindustrialization economy of the Rust Belt cities.
And that's when all those companies moved out, those factories were closing up and stuff, right?
Exactly, yeah. Steel mills, the automotive companies, and the shipyards. We're all moving overseas and down south. So that's kind of like where it was with me and my mother. But I thought ultimately it was okay living in Lorain, Ohio. Once we had transitioned from Detroit.
Does anyone have any questions about for Javon before I move on?
No, not at all. Mm-hmm. I just commend his upbringing because we don't have that now for this generation.
Yeah, you used to get whoopings, Javon, before I move on.
Yeah. I referenced the corporal punishment because, I was that generation that was like.
Yeah, I got what you meant.
Yeah, me too.
That's where it was. And I mean, ultimately, I think it helped me to be a better person. Whether her way of handling things wasn't necessarily the way we do things now. It helped me to get more discipline and helped me ultimately, I think, when I was in the military.
Right.
Because at the end of the day, you got to be able to listen and take instruction and follow suit.
Which is what you had growing up. Did your grandfather had any influence on you in reference to going into the military?
Well, it's funny you say that. So my grandfather had already he passed away when I was before I was even born, but he was okay. Kind of a core mm-hmm. person that everybody looked at. And my stepfather was in the Navy, and also my uncles, most of my uncles on my mom's side were in Vietnam or in Korea. My mom had a very big family. She had about 10 brothers and sisters spread between the Lorain and Cleveland footprint, and most of them. Coming out of that Vietnam era, they didn't necessarily have the best experience because, when they returned back home, they were,
messed up.
They didn't get the best reception. So at first they were a little hesitant and like, hey, if you're going to go to the military, you got to really be, know what you want, be ready to serve and give it all your best and ultimately have a plan where you set some goals and know when you plan on transitioning out or what you're going to do, be a lifer. And I think that really helped my perspective when it came time to choosing to go to West.
Awesome.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. So let's jump to your high school time. Okay. Dan, did you do any preparatory work for West Point? When did you decide to go to West Point or did I miss that?
Yeah, no. So it's funny. So my mom, she was really a core person in my education. Going back to elementary school, I must have went to 4 different schools. And when we lived on the west side, we moved to the east side when she met my stepfather. And so that going to that different neighborhood was a little bit different, but I was getting bused to the south side. And they had these different programs called the Magnet Program. And it was like the math science program, then they had the fine arts program, and they had all kinds of stuff like NASA. We went to this thing called Marsville for NASA at the Lewis Glenn Research Center, where they're teaching you how to brainstorm about how you would live if you were on a colony in Mars. And I was the tunnel engineer, so that was one of the things that kind of made me like, wow, maybe in the future I could be an engineer. Also they had little computer camps, but, it's funny because the whole school system wasn't always that great. You really had to have been identified. And so my mom put me from one school to another school, until she got me to the program that, was holistically going to help me in education. And so, once I got to high school, it was like a moment of like, I felt more prepared to do well in school, and I got pretty good grades. I was an honor student during that time. I think I was like third out of my class of 305, or no, I was fifth out of 305 in high school, and then I was like the president of the National Honor Society. I was the vice president of student council. I was the battalion command sergeant major for the JROTC. I was the assistant drum major for the marching band. I was the I played 5 varsity sports. I was all state track. I played varsity baseball, basketball, golf, and wrestle. And
wow!
So yeah,
did you have time to go to the restroom?
Yeah, I was listening. Mm-hmm. Keyword there was golf for me.
It was funny, golf, because that was around the time when Tiger Woods, you know, was starting to peak around 99 time period. And they had started a local program because a couple years before that, probably about almost half decade before, they had cut out the school sports, and, you know, the crime rate increased and kids were doing things wrong. And then they were like, all right, we got these new sports back in. And then they bought golf and they were like, hey, you can play free and you get a free set of golf clubs. And, you know, I was just like, that's all I had to hear. You know, I was like, right. Sure.
that's great. That was,
yeah.
Javon, so from your perspective, you know, you said your mother transferred you to different schools until she found the one that she thought appropriate for you. All right. Mm-hmm. Now, was that a public school or were those private institutions?
Yeah, these were all public schools. So, we didn't have much money. And so that's what was good about Lorraine. Like, if you're low income, you could potentially go to any school. You had to test out. And so my mom, she started me, you know, with flashcards when I was young. And I could read probably before I was, you know, in kindergarten. So, you know, that carried on throughout. And then I went to Washington, which was a regular public. Then I went to Lowell, which is on the south side, Lincoln Academy, then Lowell Academy. So these were all academies, and they had specific programs that you could be in, but it was all publicly funded. So, and then I went on to the Southview High School, which, funny enough, later on got closed down, but that was the main magnet program for the high school students.
Okay, now were they predominantly black or predominantly white?
So, yeah, it's interesting. So, like, as I mentioned, the south side of Lorraine, funny enough, if you look at the statistics, Lorraine is like about, say, 60,000 or so. And there's the west side, which was ended up being predominantly black. The white side was kind of predominantly east side. And then South Lorraine was predominantly Puerto Rican. And so that's the, you know, a lot of my best friends, you know, got to know going to school on the south side. And a lot of the girls I dated, funny enough, were of Latino descent back then. So definitely loved that that area. And, you know, that's where I got my love for rice and beans and, you know, a number of different foods.
So
I'll just leave it at that.
Okay. Okay. I hear you.
But good times there.
Okay. All right. Great. Yeah. I was just thinking, because you mentioned all of these different activities, you know, that you were exposed to, that your schools had. So that's what, you know, caused me, prompted me to just ask you whether they were white schools or black schools. Because a lot of the black schools, they didn't have, you know, those types of activities. But you said it was well-funded, so.
Well, no, I wouldn't say well-funded. Let me not say that. So a lot of the programs are, like, state or federal funded. So, like, they had some other programs called, like, Upward Bound, which was it was like a college preparatory type of summer program, which went through one of the colleges is called Oberlin College. Which was about almost 30 minutes from where Lorraine is. And you got to go and on the weekend sometimes, or during the week, you would go up there, get to meet with college kids. You took classes in the summer for math and English, like calculus and advanced English comp. We got to visit. We went on like a HBCU college tour down south. They had this Upper Bound Olympics where you would go to different colleges. I think we visited like Bowling Green, Toledo University, a couple other universities in the summer. You competing in basketball, track, or whatever sport that you did. And then they had the Urban League, had a male mentoring program, which was still outside of that, but they were incorporating and partnering in the school. So they had a breakfast program in the morning I used to participate in. I was in the Lorraine in the youth NAACP, which was an outside program, but it was basically grooming us, you know, helping us to understand about civil rights. So they had other programs there too, but the funding came around later on, I think, once the government, I don't know when it was, but they started to enhance the funding into the schools for those magnet programs and other types of college preparatory programs.
Okay. Now, I see that you, I mean, who prompted, you know, a lot of kids, even myself, when I was growing up, the pressure to do well came from my, you know, contemporaries and, of course, my home, all right, and the community. You know, if you came home with a bad report card, everybody in town knew about it before you even got home with it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So, what prompted you to do so well in school? I know, I just want to know, and I want the listeners to know.
Yeah. You know what's funny? Like, initially, my grandmother was like, you know, one of those people that was like, you know, you need to get, you know, just stay in school, get good grades. My mom had ingrained it in me. My brother and sister, you know, were also, I saw them, kind of, my sister went off to college, to University of Cincinnati. And that was one of the main things she would say to me, like, you know, where are you going to go to school? And I'm little. And he's like, I'm going to go to college. Like, you know, I couldn't even pronounce it. But I just knew, like, that was a goal, you know, to go to college. I had aunts and uncles that were first generation college graduates. They were nurses. A lot of them went to the medical field, nurses and nurse practitioners. And it was in me that I was like, I have to go to college. The key thing about it was my mom told me early on, because my sister had, you know, she had taken out a lot of loans and they put out most of their money on her education, that it was like, she said, I'm not going to be able to pay for your college. And that also had a play into choosing to go into a military academy. Because, funny enough, like going to West Point, it's a fully funded, scholarship. So it's, I think, valued at like $400,000 now. And, you actually get paid while you're at college as a stipend, because a lot of the training you do and the things that you do studying abroad and other kinds of activities, you get a chance to play Division I sports. And that was crucial because I wanted to run track or play basketball at college level. And I had a chance to do that. And the other thing was, it's just, I felt like I wanted to be an engineer. I knew that. And they had a really strong electrical engineering program that was like fourth in the country. And I really wanted to do the computers, kind of computer engineering. It was going to be a computer architectural design program. And it was really inspiring to see all of those elements come together. And at the end of the day, so many people, my family had served in the military. I was in the JROTC in high school. And I never forget, we had this cadet who came to visit.
And what does that stand for, JROTC?
That's the Junior Reserve Officer Training Corps.
Okay.
And you basically, you know, you dress up, you wear the Army uniform. I was in the drill team. I was a drill team commander. And we would compete in these competitions, like throwing, you know, rifles and, you know, doing all these different types of steps. And that was like pretty, you know, that's the fun part, you know, that the rifle team and all of that. But this cadet came and he was speaking to us almost like, you know, hometown recruiting, college, public relations court council, I think is what it's called. And I mean, this guy was like Captain America, like ready to go. He was just, you know, valedictorian, you know, all American in sport. He was just everything. And I'm like, man, I think I need to go to that place. If I'm going to go to the military, I that's where I would want to go. So. That really helped shape me in wanting to go. And my junior ROTC instructor, he was a very supportive guy. And he was like, hey, I remember my junior year, he was like, Ron, like, you know, not many people get a chance to go to West Point. And he's like, you really have a chance, you know. And I was hesitant because, you know, I was applying to a lot of different colleges. I didn't know all of it, but I was, you know, I think I got accepted to Morehouse. I was thinking about Ohio State, you know, more local.
Right.
A couple other schools, you know, it's probably about 10 different schools, but none of them really offered full scholarship. A lot of them wanted to only give you a partial scholarship. And then athletically, I ran track, but I didn't make it to state in my senior year. And I remember, you know, going to visit a lot of these colleges, I think the University of Akron, one of the coaches I met with while I was down on a college visit. And I was like, hey, you know, I did good. I made it to the regional finals. You know, this is what I jumped. You know, I think it was like 22.5 or something at the time, long jump. And he was just like, yeah, I don't know. We got a lot of guys that are good. You know, we'll see what happens. We don't have a lot of spots. And this is what's so crazy. So when I went, I made it to the final. It was the state finals in Dayton, Ohio. And I remember two guys I ran against, I took third. So if you were in the top three, you know, if you got gold, silver, or bronze, you got all-state honors. And so the one guy, Lee Evans, he ended up going to the NFL. Another guy, he ended up going to the Olympic trials. But I was like 0.5 seconds off of that guy. And he was just like, wow, you know, I felt good. I came off the finish line. And I swear it was like five or six college coaches. And literally as I'm walking, I'm getting interviewed, and they come following me to the bleachers, and they're like, yeah, we'll offer you a full scholarship right now. And I was like, wow. Like,
I would say wow, too.
Where were you at, you know, when I came to visit, you know, your college? And, you know, but it just goes to show one of those things that you really have to make it to the level, the next level, to get the offer of a full scholarship, so to speak. So those are the things I think that contributed.
What would you say, you know, to the student today in a similar situation in high school or grade school with aspirations of going to West Point? What do they need to think about?
Yeah.
All right, and do.
So it's interesting. So at one point later on, I got a chance to go back to West Point and be a what we would call Southwest Outreach Officer. It's like a diversity admissions officer. And I focused in on the southern part of the United States, and like Texas, New Mexico, and more so in the Oklahoma Southwest area. And I had to really look at what I would do to get and tell students. And so the thing is, I tell them is that it's, one, don't look at it as like it's too hard. It's possible. You know, I'm the example, and that, you know, if you get good grades, you know, you're active in the community, you have some leadership experiences, you know, you have to be good physically fit, meaning if you play a sport or like hopefully at a varsity level, if you are a person who really, they kind of look at your class rank more than necessarily like your SAT or ACT scores, though the ACT and SAT were pretty critical back then. And it's one of the main reasons why I ended up going to the prep school, because of the SAT later. And it correlated to the best of my, what I thought I was doing. And I think the other thing, you have to be medically qualified, which is basically saying that, you know, you're healthy, you didn't break any bones, or you're or current, you know, issues there, and, you know, have major illnesses. And lastly, you have to have a congressional nomination or a senator.
That's what I want to hear. That's a key thing there. How do you manage that, you know, to get that letter?
Yeah, well, it's funny. So the junior ROTC program that I was in, it started when I was a freshman. And by the time we were seniors, we had really built up that program as far as competing in competitions. We had got an honor unit with distinction. And when you get that honor unit with distinction, that gives the unit the capability to nominate a candidate to go to West Point. The funny thing about it was we didn't get it until that year that I went. And then the congressman who was for my district was who's now the senator, Sherrod Brown. And there was another guy from Lorain Catholic who ended up going and getting that slot. And so they told me, it's funny enough, they were like, hey, you can go to the Naval Academy. I got a nomination to the Naval Academy. And I'm like, wait a minute, But I didn't apply to the Naval Academy.
That's Annapolis, right?
That's Annapolis.
Oh, man.
And they were like, well, if you apply, there's a good chance you might get in. I was like, well, they both pretty much have the same standard. But at the time, it's like, you know, I just felt like West Point, you know, but it was built in 1802. It's just so much history. You got so many great presidents, astronauts, Rhodes Scholars that went there. And I felt like that was the place I wanted to be. And also, you know, I wasn't a fan of the water. my stepfather was in the Navy. And, you know, he told me some of his experiences on, you know, these ships. And these submarines, and I was just like, that last thing I want to be is stuck out in the middle of the ocean. You know, that's kind of like a joke in that. But yeah, no, definitely. I think kids can get in there if you work hard, if you're focused. And the last thing is that you really have to want it. When you go to West Point, you're gonna get. I'll say it's not easy. You know, you get in there your freshman year, you've got our day, which is reception day, the cadets are yelling at you, telling you to do push-ups, you know, like just everything you do wrong is a reason for them to, you know, find some activity for you to do, you know, or just smoke you just because they feel like it, you know. And then you go through this for, you know, that's your beast barracks is what's like your basic training. And, you know, once you complete that, you know, in the summer, you're welcome and you're accepted into the Corps of Cadets, and you feel like you've accomplished something, you know, you're still a plebe, and that freshman year, you know, you're doing random duties, taking out the laundry and getting people's mail and, you know, all these different things you have to do. And the academics there are, a bar none, are really high. I'll say this. So this is the one thing I did feel a little bit bad in out of high school was that, you know, I thought I was smart in high school. You know, I was like a junior, I got straight A's, and you know, I thought I was pretty good. And I mean, when I got there, it was just on a whole nother level. That's when you realize that there are other kids in other schools that in other states that are just astounding. I mean, we had a couple guys that were Rhodes Scholars after graduating. I mean, they all took all AP courses throughout high school. Some people were like, they maxed out their SAT scores. I mean, some of them are homeschooled, mm-hmm. you know, Eagle Scouts. You know, it was just different. Like, you're like, you know, that whole joke about, you know, Will Smith and the best of the best of the best, you know, with honors. Like, that's where you see those folks. So right. It was like, it was really a wake up call. Like, you know, you went from big man on campus to, you know, you're just average. So
right. I was going to ask if you ever felt like, you know, you wouldn't make it or within that surrounding. And how was the diversity there?
Yeah, I think that was probably one of the hardest things was graduating, because they have this method called the Bear Method. And what they do is they bombard you with tests. Like every third week is called a Thayer week, and they'll have like, you might have five or six courses, and you'll have a major like quiz or like a, you know, midterm exam in every class. And like, you talk about all nighters. Like, I was a double E major. So in the, you know, the joke was, is that our classes were in the basement. So they called it the dungeon. Cause you know, you had to go to the lab for certain things. So we, like, you didn't sleep sometimes, you know, sleep deprivation, was kind of just a thing that you just embraced. And in addition to that, you know, you couldn't really catch up during the daytime. You know, you couldn't take sleep naps and nothing, cause your room always had to be in like a pristine type of, called AMI, which is inspection ready in essence. Literally on Saturdays, you'd have Sammy, which is like they come through literally with a white glove and inspect your room. And so you really had to keep your standards up there. But I think, you know, English was one of my most difficult courses. And there was a point in time when I really was like scared, you know what I mean? I didn't do so well in one of the courses, and I actually, you know, I had to take it over, and I was like, shoot, I had to get nominations, recommendations from my teachers, my coaches because I could have gotten kicked out. And it was a moment where that's when you realize the support and the mentors, the folks that were really looking out for me, like, you know, this guy, I think he has potential. He'll make a great officer. And also playing, you know, D1 sports, that was a good thing. My coach was like, hey, we need to get, keep this guy. It was just, I was playing team handball. And my junior year, we were the national champion. And I was selected to be on the national team, alternate on the national team that went to the Pan Am Games in 2003 and ended up taking a bronze. But you know, having those people to support you and look out for me was one of the crucial things. So, you know, I mean, outside of that, when you're in basic training, you know, you have those days when you're thinking you can quit. I remember one point, you know, it was like, because I knew I had, around my freshman or sophomore year, I knew that I had other, you know, I had been accepted to other universities. You know, in the back of your mind, you're always thinking like, you know, do I want to put up with this? You know, like, you know, you're a little grumpy, you have a bad day. But at the end of the day, you know, like when you graduate, you know, it's going to be all well worth it. And you know, being a member of the alumni and just the long gray line, as they call it, I think it's probably one of the best decisions I ever could have made in the country. I mean, usually a number, I mean, West Point, as you call them, you know, reach out to them on LinkedIn, and usually, you know, they'll at least respond back to you. You may be able to, you know, do an just a informal conversation with them about their career or industries. And even from military officers transitioning out, it's just a different type of scenario. And I got my master's in management and leadership from West Virginia University. And I just didn't feel like I got that same experience. I mean, they have a great program and a huge alumni side, don't get me wrong, but it's just something different about knowing that everybody went through the same or similar experiences. It gives you, you know, that they have a certain type of pedigree in order to make it through.
Hey, can I ask you a question real quick there? Thank you for your service, by the way. And you know, your resume is impeccable, man. Beautiful. It's great to see that. Outside of the prestige of West Point and the hard work and all of those things, what would you say to a young man coming from your upbringing, a place where you came from, some of these urban communities? What would be the one thing outside of all of that other prestige that you could say West Point could offer them to carry them through the rest of their life?
I think the key thing is what it drew. I think most of the people I know is that leadership. I think it's listed as the premier leadership institution in the country, and it's in all of this. Just the statistics, I think pound for pound, they're in the top CEOs. You know, of institutions, the commanders, the generals. I mean, they can go down the list: the presidents, Eisenhower, Grant. You know, it's just the leadership experience is just above, beyond. Like, you really start off as the lowest of the low, like private, and then you move to being what they call a yearing or a yuck, which you have one person in charge of, and you're grooming that person, trying to teach them. You're doing, call it, you know, cadet troop leading training and stuff with them. Then you're a platoon leader, or you're a platoon sergeant. And then potentially even a company commander, and you're in charge of maybe like 100, 400 or 500 of them as a brigade commander, about 4,000 students. And that's really, you know, and these are in charge of, you know, your peers, which is sometimes one of the most difficult people to lead. So I think the leadership experience there is bar none. And then the academics, I mean, I want to say they're like number two in the civil engineering program, like number four in electrical engineering. I remember there was an article that Forbes magazine did, like 2009, and they were listing West Point as the number one college to go to above Harvard. And I just remember being like, wow. Like, and you know, they had a different way of ranking it based off of their waiting schedule. But, you know, it's just when you look at all the things and the benefits you have in that aspect of it, and then serving your country on top of it. And which is interesting, too, because when I got out of the Army, well, when I got into the Army, let me say, as a second lieutenant, it was around, I graduated around 2004. So it was right around the beginning of the subprime, you know, mortgage thing. It was like a bubble was about to hit. And then around 5 years, you have a 5-year commitment. You can choose to get out. And I, you know, at the time I had been a platoon leader in Korea and then Fort Bliss, Texas, Air Missile Defense, and then was a recruiter at West Point and then took the command as the AJC commander. And that's what kind of made me want to stay a couple more years. But it was hard because all the jobs were, it was like no jobs available. Everybody was trying to go to you know, get their master's in business school. So it was like a moment where it's like, you know, you might not want to get out of the military at that time. And so, but you have a guaranteed job in the military. So as long as you do well and you get promoted, that was also another, a good sense of security, you know, outside of the fact that let's not forget that, you know, there's a risk in being in the military. It's not for everybody. And there's a possibility that you could die. So, I mean, not to say that lightly, but you have to go into it with open arms and open eyes, knowing that, you know, that's a possibility.
To follow up on what Chris was asking, I want to look at it from a person that's growing up in a poor urban environment that's poor. They don't have the support that, say, let's say that you did. All right, you know, what would you, what would we tell them? You know, how would they, what do you think they should be focused on? Or what is the path that you would see for them? Oh, that's okay. You know, say a kid growing up in an urban community, you know, boy or girl, let's say in New York, and they don't have access to the facilities that you did as in when you were going to school. Okay, how would they go about, you know, being successful, you know, that with that glide path that you had?
Yeah. You know what's interesting? So I guess as I look at my transition out of the military into kind of the corporate world, and one of the key things I remember, you know, my old boss, who's a Fulbright colonel, when I was the HAC commander in charge of all the staff and faculty at West Point, And it was more so for administrative and training logistics and that thing. But he was like, you know, you need to get some skill sets that are transferable. And, you know, granted, I had my master's in management leadership. I had an electrical engineering degree, focused on computer architectural design. One of the things he said is like, you should probably take some certification type of courses. And they had Lean Six Sigma, the Green Belt training. And that was like something that I went through. It was probably one of the biggest things that at first when I got out and recruiters were looking at my resume, that they noticed that. And it was like, oh, okay. Like you understand, you know, how to, you know, do find efficiencies and product improvement things. And so doing that type of training was a good thing. Also as a recruiter at West Point, you know, that was one of the transferable skill sets. And I think that also helped me get my first role working at Michael Page International. I was a supply chain and finance recruitment executive recruiter in New York footprint. And I was working in, you know, I was working in the Chrysler building on like 29th floor. And I was just excited to be in New York City, you know, I guess doing the whole, you know, the rat race, running, you know, taking the commuter train. And, you know, that role in itself was like my wake-up call because I'm talking to all these executives, folks in finance. They're just doing, you know, huge things. And I'm like, man, how do I get into that? And funny enough, one of the things that they had was this thing called the Service Academy Career Conference. And many times, basically, this is a conference for going back to the Alumni Association, where military officers who are transitioning into the civilian force go and jobs come to this event and basically looking to hire West Point or other Joint Service Naval Academy, Air Force Academy, Coast Guard Academy graduates. And that also helped open the doors where I met one of the guys who was a Naval Academy grad, and he was a submarine guy. And, you know, he was like, hey, what do you know about finance? And I was like, well, you know, in college, I was in this little finance club another great thing that West Point offered, they have this thing called the Kyle Loan. And it was like at the time a $25,000 loan at 1%, which is crazy low if you think about it, and you're a fresh college student coming into your own, you know, life. That's like a lot of money. It's a lot of kids, you know, bought cars. At the time, I had bought a condo, and I got a car to auction. And I was like, you know, the other thing I was doing was I was investing in options, a website called Options Express.
Oh, you did? Yeah. How much did you lose?
I lost a bit, you know. It's funny. I ended up balancing out, you know. We had
a guy who... Okay.
That's awesome. You can.
Yeah, I hit my mute button by mistake. Okay. Yeah, I know Christopher has something to say about that one. Hopefully we can get him back.
I started out, I invested in, I think the worst one I think was Krispy Kreme, but I did good on some others, like Boston, you know, I mean, some of the blue chip stuff, you know, which are kind of gimmies, but it was an awesome experience to be able to do that in college a little bit. And that was kind of the biggest transferable skill set to get me into working at, you know, in the bank at RBS Citizens Bank at that time. So, and I started as the vice.
Yeah, I did want to pivot over to your, I spent so much time on your early childhood and the West Point thing that, you know, we have similar backgrounds in financial services. All right. And then that's what you do. All right. So why did you leave the military? I think it was medical. So we addressed that. We responded to that question. So how do you find financial services? And you've been there since what? 2006
Oh, actually, no, about 2010 is when I actually officially transitioned out. I was still in the National Guard after I got out of the Army. But, you know, I went into working Citizens Bank around the beginning of end of 2010, beginning of 2011-ish. I went, into foreign exchange operations. My boss at the time, one of the best leaders I had ever worked for at the time. And she, you know, her thing was like, you know, if you understand, you know, electrical engineering stuff and, you know, calculus, you can figure out, interest rate derivatives. And I was supporting the sales and trading desk at the time. We were processing. I had three teams. We were, you know, processing trades on a platform called Wall Street. And we basically.
Oh, yeah. I'm familiar. Michelle, you're familiar with Wall Street, too, right?
Oh, yeah.
That front to back system. I think it was mostly back office then. Yeah.
Back office.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was, you know, so I had to meet with the traders. And, you know, whenever they had an issue, a transaction to go through, I was the guy getting the nasty gram or the call, like, make this work. Where's the deal? You know.
Right.
You know, they sometimes don't speak in that good language.
Right.
You know, so I'm the guy who had, you know, I was
getting treated like a gopher.
Yeah, right. You know, but it was a great introduction into, you know, the finance world. You know, I was also managing the middle office, and then I had a team that was processing foreign checks for the Rhode Island and Massachusetts footprint. So it really introduced me. It was like, you know, birth by fire, if you will. And my boss recommended me for this thing called the Emerging Leader Development Program. And at the time, it was like the first time they had ever really did it formalized. And we worked on, got a chance to basically meet with senior leaders. We got to all these panels. They had this whole business and banking program we went through. And at the end of it, you worked on this big project. Mine was for anti-money laundering, trying to decrease the, get a backlog of Know Your Customer. They call it
KYC.
We were able to get that down, you know, I think from like 18 months to 6 months. So that was a big deal at the time. And they were like, you know, hey, you know, at the end of it, eventually it got to a point where they're like, we want you to interview for this other role, you know, and I was working for the vice chairman, basically as his business manager, become the head of their business support. You know, I got the role, and I was kind of shocked because I'm like, you know, when the guy called me about it, he's like, hey, you got to interview this. I'm like, for who? What? Like me? Like, you know, but at the time it was funny because they had selected me to be in this commercial that kind of like as a brand ambassador, where they shot me as a foreign exchange operations manager. And I think in that commercial, I said I wanted to be like the next level of a group operations manager or a leader. And I remember at the end of that ELDP program, I met the vice chair, and he was like, oh, you know, you seem like you're doing good things. And then lo and behold, I'll end up working for him. So it was pretty awesome. I went from like literally like working, you know, in a like a small office, you know, across town to like in like the top floor next to on the same floor as the CEO of the company, you know, next, you know, it was just a wild experience. But it was just literally like getting an MBA in a year. You know, it was basically just so many great things. I was on the operating committee, the executive committee. We had to handle a lot of the risk and regulatory reporting stuff. During that time, we got a new CEO. Wanted to like, you know, do cost cutting. We did an initial public offering. We sold off 100 bank branches. We separated from our parent company, which was RBS. So it was a lot that we did. And my role kind of transitioned from kind of being a chief of staff business support to more of a like managing strategic programs. And then that's how we built our operations PMO, basically building all that work that we were doing that were more, you know, project focused. And the main cost cutting initiative.
I understand. No, go ahead. No, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was saying it was just a great experience, and I felt like that was kind of one of the key things that launched my trajectory. I would say like if there's programs like that for the younger generation to get into, you find somebody who you feel is supporting you in some form and believes in you, and it almost becomes a mentor to you. And is willing to send you forward into those types of things, I would recommend doing.
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, now Michelle and I, we came from operations support. Right, we supported we did FX, we did options. Yeah, you remember in the money, out of the money, the premiums. Yeah. P&L. Oh, standing by the traders.
Reconciliation.
We no show reconciliations. We run that department.
MIS.
You know exactly what I'm talking about there.
Definitely.
Oh yeah. I see you have a similar background. You know. Mm-hmm.
But when I said that to Walter, I was like, I feel like I look up to him because he did it like, you know, before me. So I'm like, you know, that next generation looking up to him and to you also then, Michelle.
Yeah, that's where we met. Michelle and I met, you know.
Yeah, we met. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Commerce Bank.
We met at Swiss Bank. We met at Swiss Bank.
Swiss Bank, right.
UBS. Yeah, which is now UBS.
Right, UBS now. Such a wide range of background. You know, you sure you're a millennial?
Are you sure with 2010? 2010 is post the Great Depression. So you missed that. I got killed. I was at the top of my game then in 2008. Lehman Brothers went down, man.
Those were tough times.
My goodness.
Well, no, it's funny. I was joking when I think with Walter, we were talking at one point, and I said, I almost don't consider myself. I'm like on a borderline, you know. I graduated right at the, you know, 99, 2000 period. So I always thought they call us some Xennials, you know, the end of the millennial, the Generation X and the beginning of the millennial stuff.
Right, right.
We had the tape cassettes and, you know, I grew up listening to the 80s music and, you know, break dancing and stuff like that. So I was just younger at the time, you know.
I remember I used to go down south, you know, on vacation, And I would tell somebody, I said, what do you do? You know, I would tell someone that I work in a bank. You know, they would ask me, well, you know, what do you do for a living? And I said, yeah, I work in a bank. And the first thing that would come into their mind was, I was a teller.
Oh, well, yeah.
It was a teller, you know.
Yeah.
Well, there's a lot more to it than that. But yes.
Yeah, and it's funny, too, because, like, you have to break it down and you simplify it. And it's like, well, I work in the back office. Basically, we make sure money moves to where it needs to go.
I didn't even bother. I didn't get it. I know. That's good. Yes, absolutely. You're right. You know, there's a lot more to it. But So, I mean, how do you find, you know, corporate America is a tough place. And with your leadership qualities, you know, I mean, the skill set that you have, don't you think you should be, you know, up around the CEO level, which I always wanted to be.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to be the man.
Yeah, yeah. You know what's funny? So this is kind of interesting as I transitioned into a different role. And, you know, as I was at Citizens, it was more of like a smaller company. I think it had about, you know, maybe less than 20,000 employees. And, you know, they say the joke of like, you can be like a big fish in a small pond or a small fish in a big pond.
Yeah, yeah. And,
you know, and at that time, you know, I was thinking like, you know, I had my responsibility had grown threefold. You know, I was, you know, getting a little bit more money, but it just wasn't exactly where I wanted it to be. And then I got an opportunity to interview for a role at GE. And, you know, GE at the time, I think they might have had almost 300,000 employees. Like they were, you know, the monstrosity, like, you know, top 10 global company. And so I got the opportunity. I went to work in their enterprise initiatives in their PMO because I was currently working in a strategic PMO kind of role. As focused more on the project side, and they had been designated as a SIFI, which is a systemically important financial institution, and basically too big to fail. And a month after I went into that role, the GE Capital had made the announcement they were going to sell the company. Like, you know, and I think they must have sold it was like $188 billion, something like $200 billion worth of the business over those 2 years. And immediately my role changed. It was like light day. I'm like, I was going over there trying to enhance these program management stuff. And now I'm like thinking, what can we simplify? Like, what's my next role?
Yeah. You had to merge. Did you work on you had to merge all the activities and processes and which one had the best process versus the legacy and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah. Well, I did that reduction. We had like a strategy plan. We were trying to like consolidate on what we were going to work on and what we minimize. And then my role basically went away once we had, you know, equalized our operating mechanisms. And then they said, hey, we have another opportunity we want you to look into. So that, I got that opportunity working at the global operations support lead, which is where I was managing like the operations infrastructure, the guys who basically process all the transactions for the GE businesses and treasury, which is, we ended up going from 5 shared service centers to 7. We were in Cincinnati, Mexico, Bucharest, India, China, Japan, and Connecticut. And so basically, you know, I was doing that, managing all the payment processing. And then because we did transition service agreements when I was when we were selling off the bank branches at Citizens, I knew about some of that program as one of the portfolio in my portfolio. So I ended up managing that program for the cash management program, processing and off the divested businesses that were sold from GE Capital to the new company. So I was in charge of that treasury, the transition service agreement program. So that was kind of like my play on, you know, being involved with some of those divestitures, you know, a little bit of the M&A space. They also did a spinoff of Synchrony. During that time.
Synchrony Bank, yeah.
Yeah, which is the consumer finance business. So, you know, I had I touched a little bit of this stuff here and there. I was in charge of the business continuity planning piece, which is basically the disaster recovery plan.
Yeah, yeah.
So, mm-hmm. Yeah, I touched a little bit of everything in there. And then, you know, at the end of it, you know, I knew my role was going away. So it was a moment where I was like, okay, I did this well, you know, we got pretty good, you know, on our bonuses, you know, got paid out 100% on each one of those. We met our goals, and I that was when me and my wife were thinking about having kids. So I got the got a package, you know, and that was like an interesting process, you know, when you get that reduction in force. But when I got a chance to go home for a year, and then after that, I got the role working at MicroFocus at the Global Treasury Transformation.
Yeah, we have similar backgrounds. I mean, but do you ever get that feeling that you're last in, first out?
Well, yeah, it kind of was that. It was funny though. Yeah, because I knew it. I was like, I got in there, literally I was a month in, and it was like, oh man, I stepped into something. But you know what's funny? I value that experience because I learned the most from that. And it was, I didn't take it in a bad way. I mean, I feel like I was still young in my career and I knew I was going to, you know, find something else. And it was almost a moment of like the guys I know who did stay, you know, folks, you know, 20, 30 years, like you go to GE, people, they just don't leave, you know? So it was,
it's up to us. Yeah. You find, the other ones, but you won't find us been there 30 years.
No.
We've been laid off long time ago.
So
that's my observation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was, I definitely knew.
Thanks.
I seen a little bit of that when I was at RBS Citizens, you know, and similar at GE. So, you know, if you're one of the things I tell, you know, some of the guys coming up, I say, you know, you always got to be thinking about what's next. You know, even in that role, you can be over delivering, achieving your goals or, you know, hitting everything, getting rated really high. But there's always a chance. You never know. The company you sold, you know, they looking at you as a golf target.
Yep. Downsize.
It's
always possible.
Those synergies. Yeah, big looking at the synergies, man.
That's right.
Yeah. But before we move on. Mm-hmm. Yeah, go ahead, Michelle.
No, I was going to mention him supporting Black-owned businesses. I wanted to get touch a little bit on that.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, yeah. So can you just tell us about your family and friends entrepreneurship endeavors that you have?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's funny, like, I guess growing up, you know, I mentioned my grandmother just getting us into the whole, like, volunteering community service. And, you know, throughout high school, it was JRTC, we were doing, you know, food drives and, you know, you're doing all kinds of like pancake breakfasts and stuff. And that continued on throughout the corporate world and, you know, Hope Habitat for Humanity and different types of, you know, Hope for Haiti, things I've had a chance to do. But, you know, more recently in the past couple of years, like I felt like, you know, as we talk about like the Black owned businesses, and I remember hearing a stat where, you know, they were saying like at one point there was like 40 Black owned banks and then, so now there's like, you know, less than 10 or something like that. I think the exact number is 4 or something.
I think it's four.
Yeah. And it's crazy because it's like, that's where we need the most investment. It's like, you know, that's not a small business, but the Black-owned business. So a number of my cousins and family members have done things and they've, you know, really done well for themselves. One of my cousins, funny enough, she started a lingerie line. And I remember when she was a Ford model. You know, she's been in Vogue and InStyle and Bazaar and all these Glamour, Cosmopolitan. And then at one point she was like, you know what? It's nice doing that, but I think she is at a point where she was like, wanted to actually be the person who was owning the business. So hats off to her when she started her company, Liberté, you know, was really like just a really startup. And she, I was more of like an advisory board person looking at her business plan and finances and things of that nature. But she's now like more recently was just, got her. She's her. You can find her lingerie in Bloomingdale's. Yeah.
Okay.
And it's online. It was just an InStyle magazine in December. So it was. Awesome. You know, she's done really well for herself. Got really good investment. Another cousin also. She's actually a poet, a director, and a hall. Her name is Bempe Fajiembo, and we were able to be, me and my wife made a film called Love and Zodiac. She's also a actress, writer, and director. She made a film before, and so that was my first introduction into being executive producer for that film, and I did a little acting myself.
give us the links to that or something.
Yeah, I'm putting it in the chat room, definitely.
All right, great.
But yeah, so the film Boju Weigh In is going to be in the Tribeca. Got submitted to the Tribeca Film Festival. And so hopefully you don't have some things going on well with that. And, you know, just a number of great people and young and up and coming, this next generation doing great things. So as that's I get amazing. A chance to, that's how I've found and had an opportunity to give back, you know, just try to like, you know, give some love and show support wherever I can.
Awesome.
Excellent. That's great.
Yeah, we're pushing up against the clock. So yes. Chris, you have any questions or comments for Javon?
Yeah, he's working at Johnny Ruth's Steakhouse.
Yeah, well, yeah, man has a day job.
Move on. That's right.
He has a day job. How about you? I'm sorry,
guys. I'm here. I'm chopping up some eggs now to go on the stage. So, I had to open the screen up. But listen, man, it's fantastic hearing everything that you're involved. I wanted to tell y'all, right, this is going back a lot of years. My very first job was at Oppenheimer.
I remember Oppenheimer.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I was a cold caller. I don't know if you know what you guys. I think I was making $3.35 an hour at that time. And they wanted me to wear a suit. Right. They wanted me to wear a suit and tie every day. And I'm like, I'm making $3 an hour. You want me to come here and wear a suit and a tie? But I didn't stick with it. But a friend of mine, he got into the program as well, and he stuck with it. He became very successful in that world. But I got a small peek into it, doing what I was doing. And it's a tough place to be, man. Yeah. When you come from certain communities and you don't see yourself there. Like, I didn't see a lot of people that look like me.
Right.
But I was happy that my boy stuck it out and he became successful. And I'm happy that you guys stick it out. Like, it's not easy, and it's good to hear these stories about people who go through the trenches and, you know, work hard and struggle and push themselves to be great and to do great things. I'm looking forward to seeing that movie. Good luck.
Yeah.
Glad to talk.
I'm definitely going to look at it.
Thanks, Johnny Rouge. We appreciate you jumping in.
Yeah, Chris. Thank you, man. You have a profitable, fruitful weekend.
Super Bowl weekend, yes, that's right.
I'm
working on it, you know?
Yeah. I'm from Ohio, so I'm rooting for Cincinnati.
That's right.
Listen, I know you're starving for it over there, so good luck to Cincinnati.
Yeah, I'm going to go with Cincinnati.
Yeah. Anytime you're doing great things, man, with your business, remember Johnny Roots. We come and make some great food for you, man. We'll make it happen.
Definitely. I'm going to check it out. My wife is from the city. She lived in Staten Island in the Bronx.
I'm in Staten Island. Awesome. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's great.
So we make it out there. We'll check it out.
Yeah. You also leaning towards entrepreneurship too, right? Gradually?
Yeah, gradually. I mean, I've done a little bit, you know, stuff here. I'm looking at, I won't put any of the energy out there yet to put the pressure on me. But, you know, hopefully working to, you know, create a, you know, some apps or, you know, within a digital banking space. It's a really interesting place now. You know, we've got a lot with blockchain. You've got, you know, the non-fungible token.
The NFTs. Yeah, I've had to study that because it caught me off guard. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's a lot out there, and you know that's where I think the future of banking and payments are going.
Apps
transition to PayPal, and banks are now, you know, you see less brick and mortar.
Right.
And I remember
everything is via app now.
I can't even find a Capital One out here, man.
It's hard to find a brick and mortar. You know, I love Capital One, but it's hard to find a brick and mortar. And you got a lot of companies like Affirm and SoFi. A lot of those things traveling in that direction. So, it's getting tough. Yeah. You got to be very aware of what's going on.
And then you got security exposure when you're using your device, your cell phone or something. And then you got to be very careful with that. You know, so it's a mess. But hopefully, you know, we'll get through it like we got through everything else, right?
Yeah,
so, for sure.
I think that's just going to have to happen, you know.
All right.
Security's got to be real.
All right, so I'm going to turn it over. And again, thank you, Javon, you know, for spending this time with us and helping us to push out information to our listeners. And who we got coming up next?
Oh, boy. I'm excited because, you know, it's Black History Month. We have, for next Friday, newly elected Bronx Borough President, a return guest, Miss Vanessa Gibson. Friday at 6 p.m. Yeah, we're excited to have her. And then we have Women's History Month coming up. Yeah, yeah, I'm excited for her because she's very active in the Bronx and throughout the city, you know.
Yeah.
She works closely with the mayor, so I'm excited to hear what she has.
And she made history, right? She made history.
She definitely made history. She's the first black. That's right. She sure did.
That's
amazing. Yeah, that's huge. That is huge. So we have a lot of things coming up. We also have some Monday night shows coming up as well with some great guests. So please follow our website for updates, www.thewaltweekly.com, and also on IG and Facebook, The Walt Weekly. You will find updates there as well. But also, Walter has a new blog that he calls Walter's Corner.
Okay.
Every week he makes writes what's going on in during the week, how he feels about something that he is interested in during that week. So you guys, please follow The Walt Weekly on Podbean. And Javon, we really appreciate you. You have an amazing resume, bio. And I salute you for everything you've done and contributed to in the community and towards your family and The Walt Weekly, for sure.
And thank you for having me on here. I appreciate the opportunity to come on here and share my story. And I think what you guys are doing a great work. I think these are the stories people need to hear.
Definitely.
You got relevant, very good topics. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to continue to share it.
Definitely. And when you come out with your entrepreneurship, we're going to bring you back on.
All right.
Yeah, you got to come back, Yeah.
Come back. Let us know what you're doing. That's right. That's right. Put the pressure on and come back to The Walt Weekly. Maybe you could design an app for us. Yeah.
I think you're hanging. Michelle, you're hanging around me too long.
I'm picking up. He's in the background saying the same thing. And myself as an entrepreneur. We appreciate you. We appreciate our live audience for joining us. Thank you for your comments in the chat room. We look forward to you all staying with us for our next week, Friday Live, and also we have a show on Monday, the following Monday after the Friday Live. So you can follow us, like I said, at thewaltweekly.com, IG and Facebook, The Walt Weekly, Twitter, Walt Weekly, Podbean, The Walt Weekly. You can find us on iTunes, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Pandora, and other streaming platforms. Please also support our sponsors, Michelle Sweeney Hair Care, on IG and Facebook, and also our intro and outro music, a talented musician who happens to be my handsome son, Uncle Nephew. You can find him on Instagram.
I'm just adding one more thing before we
sign up. Yes, sir.
And these are for the people from my area, North Carolina and Virginia. We do have Muta Evans coming in on the 25th,
which
is 2 weeks from tonight. And she was one of the first black women to own a radio station in this country.
That should be exciting. Yeah.
That should be, all right. Yes.
A lot of great women coming in. So you guys, please come back and make sure you join us next week, Friday.
All right. Have a good weekend, everybody.
Have a good Super Bowl, everybody.
Yeah. All right.
Good night.
Be safe.
That's right. Cheers.
Bengals. Yeah, go Bengals. Cheers. All right. Bye.